Okay. So when Luis asked if I would come and give a talk, I asked whether his group would be more interested in hearing about quasi-neural modes of rapidly rotating black holes or some recent work I did with some people at Caltech on tidally perturbed neutron stars. And he said, well, both. So it'll be a two-part talk, two shorter talks. So if you find yourself not liking the first part, be patient. It'll be completely different in like 20 minutes. So to begin with, I want to talk about the quasi-neural modes of rapidly rotating black holes, very rapidly rotating black holes. And this is some work that I participated in with a lot of people at Caltech mostly, but also elsewhere. And these are the references to the two papers we put out on this work. Now, we're interested in nearly extremal Kerr black holes. And what we mean is that if you take 1 minus the spin parameter of the black hole, which saturates at 1, this is going to be some small expansion parameter that we're going to use to simplify the equations of black hole perturbation theory. And so this is sort of the motivational slide. We've got mathematical reasons to study this particular case. When you've got a near extremal situation, the geometry of the Kerr black hole gets very simple. And in fact, there are analytic solutions available to black hole perturbation equations in closed form in terms of hypergeometric functions, which is very nice. There's also real astrophysical reasons to consider this kind of situation. There's a famous paper by Kip Thorne in 1974 where he showed that material accreting onto a real astrophysical black hole would tend to saturate the black hole spin at a really quite high spin parameter. And then finally, there's also interest in this Kerr CFT duality where a truly extremal Kerr black hole has essentially the structure of an ADS spacetime. And so with these in mind, it turns out, of course, that there's a lot of history here. So quasi-neural modes, which are the natural decaying oscillations of black holes, have been studied for ages. And because this limit is nice analytically, it, of course, has also been studied for ages. So in 1980, Detweiler was one of the first people to point out that as you took the spin high, it turned out that there were many, many, many of these natural modes with very weak decay. In fact, the decay appeared to be vanishing as the spin went up to maximal. But unfortunately, people assumed some wrong assumptions about scaling and had the wrong equation for how these mode frequencies actually behave. And that wasn't corrected until Hod in 2008 actually did the analysis correctly. And this is the form of the quasi-neural mode frequency. So the leading order part is just, it turns out, the azimuthal quantum number times the horizon frequency of the black hole. And then you have this correction, which is scaling with square root of epsilon. You've got basically an overtone structure, so the damping rate of the modes is evenly spaced in overtone. And then you've also got this parameter, which, depending on whether it's real or imaginary, will also add an extra small correction to either the frequency or the decay rate. And that parameter is defined here. Now, in Hod's, yeah. This is the dependence on A, right? Remember, epsilon is 1 minus A. So we've already assumed that all A's are 1 minus epsilons. So this has already been done. And the thing about Hod's solution was it was unclear the range of validity of these frequency solutions. Is it true for all azimuthal modes greater than 0? It's clearly not true for less than 0 because in that case, it turns out that some of the assumptions are violated. No, I'm sorry. So throughout this talk, I think there will be no capital M's, which are the masses of the black hole. M here is the azimuthal quantum number of the quasi-neural modes. So for those not familiar with quasi-neural modes, they have quantum numbers indexing them just like the eigenvalues of the hydrogen atoms. So there's an L and an M. The angular quantum number is L. The M is the usual phi direction azimuthal quantum number. And then there's also an overtone number N. And that overtone number showing up here, and the azimuthal number is here, and then the angular quantum number is hiding in this angular eigenvalue quantity. So they're all hiding in there. So S here stands, oh, so S here stands for the spin. It turns out that for perturbations around black holes, you worry about the spin of the perturbation itself. So as you may know, electromagnetic perturbations are spin one. Gravitational perturbations are spin 2 or minus 2, and then scalar perturbations have no spin. So depending on what you're interested in, you plug that in for the spin there. So in trying to understand this better, the way we actually came to this was we were studying high-frequency perturbations of Kerr black holes, in which case another analytic simplification is available. And while we were studying this, we found something interesting happening. If we computed using our high frequency results the decay rate of the quasineural modes as we vary over this mu parameter is essentially standing in for m throughout the rest of the talk. It's m divided by the angular quantum number. You can sort of actually think about it as the inclination angle of the mode above the equatorial plane, roughly speaking. When mu is 1, you're in the equatorial plane. When mu is 0, the mode is primarily going around the polar axis. And when this thing is less than greater than a certain amount, it turned out that these modes would have zero decay as we took the spin up from 0.9 to 0.99999. But all these other ones would still have non-zero decay. So that would seem to indicate that Hod's expression only has a small range of validity. So we wanted to study this further. And so what we actually did was we did some numerical computations and did this big numerical search and tried to figure out what was going on. And what we found surprised us. Okay? So rather than having the situation where for azimuthal quantum numbers large enough, the modes would go to zero decay as you took the black hole to very rapid spin, and for lower azimuthal numbers, it would have decay, we found that actually you always had modes with small decay, which would go to zero, which we called zero damping modes. They have zero damping in the extremal limit. They always exist for any m value and any l value. They always exist. But for these azimuthal quantum numbers, which were large enough, it would turn out that these would only have zero damping modes. And for the smaller one, there would be yet another family. So actually, everything below this high frequency prediction, the green line, there are two kinds of modes here. Some that will go to zero decay as you go to extremal holes, and some which will not go to zero decay as you have extremal holes. Now, this is actually a bit of a puzzle. So first, let's talk about the physical understanding we developed of what's going on here. Okay? It turns out that the equations of black hole perturbation theory that you solve for these mode frequencies basically look a lot like the usual Schrodinger equation, and that you solve them in a usual sort of eigenvalue, eigenfunction way of doing things. And each family of modes is actually going to be associated with an extrema in this scattering potential. And what we found was the reason for this dual different families of modes, these two pairs of families of modes, is that for some values of the azimuthal quantum number, for some families of quasineural modes, there would actually be two extrema. There's always going to be an extrema at the horizon. And there could be an extra extrema somewhere farther away from the horizon. So here's R, here's the potential. The horizon's always set at 1, because this is a nearly extremal black hole. But as you raise the azimuthal quantum number up, this peak would get shallower and flatter and start to merge onto the horizon, then finally go away for equatorial modes. Okay? So our interpretation then is that this is like a double well harmonic oscillator. Okay? There's a very deep well sitting here. And it hosts all of the modes whose decay rates are small in the near extremal limit and eventually go to zero. And there's an additional well here, which is shallower, supports only a few modes, and actually goes away for a certain range of the parameter space. And the modes which retain finite damping, even the extremal limit, they sit on these peaks. And so the sort of puzzle here is that it's known that for very small spins, like Schwarzschild, where spin is zero, on up to smaller spins, people had studied this, and they found that for a given fixed angular quantum number and azimuthal quantum number, the overtones just sort of stacked on top of each other. They all had a greater decay than the other, and they all sort of lay in some line of increasing decay. So here in the complex plane, these dark spots are the frequencies, and this is the real part of the frequency, this is the imaginary part of the frequency. They just sort of got, for each n going up from 0, 1, 2, and 3, 4, and so on, they'd get higher decay rates. Okay? And so what we're finding now is that somewhere in between zero spin and 1, this behavior will actually change, and this single branch will actually break. And some of the modes will come off the branch, and you can no longer uniquely identify them by some monotonically increasing decay amount. Okay? And so it turns out that happens at a very high spin. Here we're raising spin from 0.973 to 0.975 for scalar waves. We thought this bifurcation of the spectrum was this neat discovery we had found. And we went and asked people who knew what they were talking about, experts in the field, and they said, wow, that's totally new. I didn't know that the modes divided into two families when you got to high spins. It turns out that Lieber, who's a big name in this field for three or four papers in the 80s and then never worked again in this field, he'd already discovered this a long time ago for one particular case, and no one seems to have noticed, and people seem to have forgotten. But what we did was we examined it for a whole range of different quasi-neural modes and found that it is a robust behavior across the whole space of possible modes. So here's another example where you have a single monotonic family in decay, but when you raise the spin, these are the zero damping modes, we call them. This entire line will just stay evenly spaced and collapse down to zero decay as we raise the spin to a high value. These modes, meanwhile, will just sit there. And so to illustrate that a little better, I just threw in a couple illustrations where if you plot each line as a single mode as you increase the spin up from 0.9, which is somewhat high spinning, but not really that high spinning, to extremely close to 1. And for the damped modes, they just sort of don't do a lot. Their real part of their frequency sort of grows a little bit, and their decay rate shrinks only a little. These guys, meanwhile, come here. They all, at different spin values, all seem to pass through the same sort of special point, and then they reverse their trend, and they all collect. Okay, and this is for L equals 2, spin equals minus 2. This mode's especially important because in terms of real perturbations to real black holes, this is one of the quadrupolar perturbations that is most likely to be seen in gravitational wave detectors following like a black hole merger. Yeah?
And so they see multiple mergers at 0.5, but there should be also...
Yeah, so in this case, 0.5, remember, is the real part, is the horizon frequency here. So m equals 1, so this is 1 over 2. So this is the horizon frequency.
And do they all do that?
Yeah, every single one other than these three that we've checked, and you can go pretty high up in the stack, they all collapse down to here.
Yeah. You get the
1/2
or the
1/2? L equals 10 will go to, it's remember the horizon frequency is m divided by 2.
Okay.
So for L equals 10, m equals 7. L equals 10 is nice because it compares to our high frequency results well, so we can do some analytic checks. Yes, they all collapse down to 3.5 for the real part of the frequency. They all collapse down to the horizon frequency times the azimuthal number, except for the finite number of damped modes, which just sort of stop. Okay? And again, in this case, all of the modes, these are the first four, there are 5, 6, 7 on up, they all come down, pass through this point, and collapse down to there. And so, all right, so we thought we discovered something new about the spectrum of black holes, but even this discovery of bifurcation, while kind of interesting, and the intuition that fast-spinning black holes are sort of like double-well oscillators, which people hadn't really thought about before, is really not so exciting yet until you try to apply it. So we tried to apply this now following some work Glenpodox and Anderson had done about 10 years ago or so. And we want to actually figure out, based on these natural decaying modes and their placement, what is the actual emission, gravitational wave emission, of a perturbed black hole? So how do we do this? Well, generic perturbations will excite a prompt response, but then this natural frequency ring down, this quasi-neural mode ring down. And the way this ring down comes about is that when you integrate the Green's function of the black hole perturbation theory along the real line, you actually convert this integral into a contour integral. And part of this contour integral will wrap around these frequency poles. This is the frequency complex plane. And these poles in the complex plane are those quasi-neural mode frequencies. And what happens is that the integral gets converted, the integral over the source from the Green's function gets converted into a discrete sum of quasi-neural modes where you take the poles of the Green's function. They're all simple poles, so I can write it like this. Okay, and so we want to compute that actual scalar field response to some generic source given this high spin behavior of the quasi-neural modes. Yeah? That's correct.
So when saying a generic source, what do you mean?
Well, no, you can do this for a true source. There's this long-standing fact that the quasi-neural modes themselves, the eigenfunctions, are not a complete set of eigenfunctions, which just means that you can't decompose every single response signal into a quasi-neural mode response, some sum of them. But this is a totally different statement. What this is saying is, give me some source, either initial data or like a particle that falls into the black hole. This is the actual Green's function which you can compute. By folding the source with this Green's function, you get the real response. What the incompleteness of the quasi-neural modes tells you is that this is not the total response. This is a piece of it. And that there's, in fact, as I said, there's a prompt response that actually comes from this piece of the contour, but that's essentially just an immediate signal from the particle. Like if you flicked a light bulb on and off, it would be the initial burst of the light. The quasi-neural modes are what happens when the light sort of gets trapped around the black hole and leaks out later in a sort of a series of decaying oscillations. So there's, in addition, something I'm not talking about today, but is actually quite important, is also this branch cut, which contributes yet a third piece. So the incompleteness of the quasi-neural modes just tells you that this isn't the whole story, but it turns out that for certain chunks of your observational time, this is the only important part of the story. Say again? Right, that's just the direct propagation of the information of the source across the black hole spacetime to something else. But so if the source, for instance, falls behind the black hole horizon, then that prompt response goes away, and all you see is the quasi-neural modes that were set up by that source. That's the common ring down situation that you see in black hole mergers. Yeah, please ask questions. I know we got a late start, but please ask for clarifications. So there's a little bit of a difficulty here in trying to come up with an interesting signal, which is that a weak decay also means that the mode's going to be hard to excite. And what that means in practical terms is that these poles of the Green's function are all going to be proportional to the small parameter. So you would actually kind of be depressed at this point and say, all right, I might excite an interesting response, but it's going to be so weak I'll never pick it up in a gravitational wave detector, for instance. So again, we are following the footsteps of Glamfordox and Anderson, who did the same analysis but with the incorrect frequency formula. They found a late time power law decay as opposed to an exponential decay that you normally find for quasi-neural modes when you did the analysis of this Green's function response at high spins. So we wanted to revisit their calculation, and it's actually pretty simple to do. As just the most basic example, we chose a scalar wave. We chose some simple scalar initial data, which we set at some large R0, just a delta function source at some large source radius. And then you watch at a large radius yourself, so your detector is set far away from the black hole. And then this retarded time parameter is going to be the time parameter here. And what happens is that that sum over modes looks like this. You have the real part of the frequency here. You, as I promised, have the weak factor here, which suppresses the signal. Then you have the sum over the decay rates here. And this beast is actually just sort of a generalized geometric series, it turns out. And so you can actually put it in Mathematica and get an answer. And it looks like 1 over 1 minus x, like you'd expect. And so you get this actual analytic result. And it may not be easy to see immediately, but it turns out that for retarded times that are early, in the sense that they're smaller than 1 over this small parameter, the epsilon here actually cancels with an epsilon in there, and you get a signal of order unity. And then at late times, as all of the other higher damping quasi-neural modes damp away, this collective oscillation reduces just to the lowest damped quasi-neural mode.
More power is expressing than you might have a breakdown of the perturbation series. Mm. Do you know you're safe from that kind of thing here?
No, that's a good question. So the very high n here, when n gets large enough, when n plus a half gets really big, it starts to compete with the smallness of epsilon. And it's not clear what happens then. There's a lot of work that people have done on what happens asymptotically for very high decay rates. And so yes, this series will truncate at some finite n. It turns out that that truncation of that finite n actually basically gives you the same kind of a thing. It's just that the very early time divergence here, notice this diverges at retarded time zero, that smooths away. But even worse, since we don't really know what happens at those high n, you might worry that the extremely high damp modes will somehow spoil this. But we have an we actually checked that by doing numerical simulations that I'll show you in a minute. So it turns out that this analytic result works great.
Because it's early
as possible. Say that again. So you've got
Early cons. Right?
Yes.
So when time is much less.
Yes. Yes.
That is exactly what you cannot trust.
So you can't this won't be entirely correct because at very very early times, yes, exactly. This will be swamped by the prompt signal. So the true. Let me just show you what this looks like. So here's the plot of that function at early times on a log time plot. At early times, you have the 1 over t, and then this gives way eventually to exponential decay, and the point at which it gives way depends on how fast the black hole spins. The faster the black hole spins, the longer this 1 over t is a good approximation, and you're completely right. For this region, early times, the prompt response and some other details will give you a completely different behavior here, right? Because this plot is basically saying that the quasi-neural modes sort of all rung up together to unity instantaneously at some initial time, which is crazy. So we've got this beautiful analytic result, but a lot of lingering questions like this. So what do? Well, we make some numerical comparisons. So we got together with one of our Anil Zanginolu at Caltech, who's both great at analytics and great at numerics. And he evolved a Gaussian pulse of initial scalar data using the spectral Einstein code, which is used at Caltech for fully nonlinear runs. But in this case, we had a fixed Kerr background. He used hyperboloidal coordinates, which means that you can actually take those coordinates all the way to infinity and compactify the domain and get a true answer for what the waves look like at infinity from the simulation without doing any sort of wave extraction. And he put the pulse very close to the horizon, which actually violates one of the assumptions we made when we made that response, which is that we set the source kind of far from the black hole. That turns out not to matter. So he sets a Gaussian pulse at r equals 1.2. He gives it a half width, half max of 0.2. We use horizon penetrating coordinates. And this is the result. So we do this for different values of the epsilon parameter. And sure enough, here, ringing up, and then with some wacky behavior up here is the details of the source. That totally comes from the Gaussian. But notice that for each individual spin, that early time is all the same, so that's sort of spin independent. But what happens at later times is the quasi-neural modes. And the quasi-neural modes are doing exactly what we predicted. For an extremely high spin, they have this beautiful 1 over t behavior all the way out to late times. For the smallest epsilon, it's actually hard to even see any of that 1 over t behavior because it's sort of buried in the initial thing, and you've already got exponential decay. But this is that thorn saturation limit I mentioned. And even in this case, you get some definitive 1 over t for some period of time followed by the exponential decay. And
this is for scalar wave?
Yeah, this is scalar.
This is L equals two.
Yes, that's correct. There's only n. So that's a good question. The Gaussian pulse was a Gaussian radial pulse, and then the angular distribution was a L equals two, M equals two spherical harmonic, which means that you're only going to excite, mostly speaking, the L equals two, M equals two response from the black hole. Okay. And so that's just a nice picture. Here's the actual comparison. The dots are numeric data where he took each of these curves and at different times divided the value for different spins by each other and compared that to the predictions of the analytic result, which are the lines here. And you can see that the agreement is quite good except at very early times. And so this convinces us that we did the right thing and that that analytic solution, despite some concerns about large n's and other things, it works pretty well. So just to finish up this piece of the talk, We want to think about future work. Well, obviously, this power law response is interesting because it's a slower decay than the quasi-neural modes, and it also implies a much larger amplitude than you would have naively expected for fast-spinning holes. So we might want to actually consider detectability of what happens if you, say, drop a small black hole into an extremely rapidly rotating supermassive black hole. So prospects for space-based gravitational wave detectors like LISA. What's also interesting is when exactly, what spin parameter does this definitive sort of change in the behavior of the black hole set in? Right? We've got some characteristic definitive changes. The spectrum bifurcates. Okay? And this analytic approximation gets better and better and better as the spin raises. How might one sort of characterize what one means by a near extremal Kerr black hole? And then, of course, perhaps of most interest to this group, the Kerr CFT duality or other kinds of connections to the work people do in ADS CFT might be of interest, starting with these results and using them as a springboard to other topics. Of interest possibly to the mathematical community are recent results which showed that actual extremal Kerr black holes are unstable in a very specific way. And the instability sort of has some echo of the behavior we're seeing here. And so one might consider what our results say about those kinds of instabilities that are mathematically rigorously sort of demonstrated by mathematical relativists. So this is a stability discovered by Aratakis first in extremal Reissner-Nordström black holes and then later generalized to Kerr. The instability basically says that if you have an extremal horizon and you put some perturbation on the space-time, the perturbation at the horizon will not decay, but the perturbation throughout the rest of the space-time will, so that over time you get a jump discontinuity in some quantities at the horizon. Yeah, so it's a sort of a weird instability. But it echoes the same situation where near the horizon you have a collection of oscillators that are decaying very slowly, sort of slow decay rates in the near extremal limit.
With respect to different values of A, the length of time for which you see the one over T changes, can you then have kind of an empirical law of what would be the delta T versus A, and then just say, well, if you have a merger of black holes, like non-spinning, that they would have a speed of 0.6, how long would that
So unfortunately, we can't talk about spin of 0.6, right, because that's so far out of the extremal regime. Part of what should be seen here is that everything depends on the square root of 1 minus a. And actually, things only turn on at around a equals 0.99. So the same question you just asked could be asked for spins sufficiently large enough to actually have any of these considerations come into play. And again, that's only really going to happen when the spectrum starts to bifurcate and all that hierarchy of modes start to line up into one sort of family. But yes, this cutoff here, this t less than 1 over square root of epsilon, t greater than 1 over square root of epsilon, if you actually compare that to the times at which the real signal deviates from the 1 over t, it does match up. So you could, in principle, if you could somehow figure out these windows, determine that.
The behavior is smooth, right? So even if you have a well-controlled approximation at a very high speed, you should be able to plot it and see if there is any sense in extrapolating these two.
So I think that's part of what's strange about this, is that there really does seem to be, not obviously a discontinuous, right, but a qualitatively different picture here, where before, at some early spin, you have mode 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, all along a diagonal. But then, at some intermediate spin, this mode decides, oh, now I'm in the extremal limit. I'm going to totally turn my behavior around. And then at a slightly higher spin, the next guy says, oh, I'm in the extremal limit. I'm going to turn my behavior around. So, sure, there's going to be some kind of smooth family. But without any analytic results like this available at lower spins, and with these kind of numerical results showing us some pretty sharp changes in behavior at high spins, it's not clear that it's going to be easy to extrapolate below 0.99, unfortunately. But that's why I emphasize that maybe if a black hole's been accreting for a while, it could actually be spinning quite fast. And this may be interesting for real black holes. It may not be interesting for black holes created by mergers, right, where the spins always go down. So this is intermission time. So if there's any other questions about this sort of stuff,
How sharply do you know when this bifurcation sets in, the value of epsilon? Do you have some sort of estimate on this?
Yeah, so actually, we couldn't, from the analytic results, get a sense of that epsilon yet, because the modes which don't, the modes which continue to stay damped, they're again on a different peak in the potential. So you have to do a completely different analysis around that peak. That peak doesn't have a small expansion parameter associated with it. So those modes are in some sense always stay sort of non-extremal in the sense that there's no small parameter that controls their frequencies. You'd have to do a totally separate analysis. So I think another thing one could add into future work, and which sort of tags along with this sort of this sort of vague bullet point of characterizing the transition, is just that question. For each L and M, when do these modes start to do this transition? And all we've got right now is sort of a big numerical study. And we have in our paper some estimates for when that might happen. I don't have that plot in this, but we do have a curve that in the WKB limit sort of gives us an estimate of when that could happen. Yeah. And it's an angular quantum number dependent answer. Anything else about quasi-neural modes? Because if not, we'll turn to something completely different. No GR at all, actually. This is a topic that was interesting to work on because it had some... Well, we were motivated to work on it because it has some applications to gravitational wave science, but it's actually completely a question of Newtonian physics. Okay, and this is the study of the stability of neutron stars to tidal perturbations. And even though we're going to be talking about neutron stars, which are quite compact objects, they're pretty well approximated by Newtonian gravity in a lot of ways. And so that's what I mean by we're going to do this problem in Newtonian gravity to try to understand some details here. So this is some work I did recently with Tejaswi Venumadov, who's a grad student in Tapir at Caltech, and Chris Harada sort of guided us through this extremely difficult problem and motivated us to work on it in the first place. He's currently at Ohio State. He was at Caltech. I think he's still listed as Caltech faculty, though. So let's just start talking about tidal interactions in neutron star binaries. So neutron star binaries are of interest to the gravitational wave community, of course, because they're the most prolific and important source for LIGO, for advanced LIGO. Okay, they're the systems we're going to see first, almost certainly. Okay. And so they're going to be systems that we study very carefully because we need to characterize the evolution of these binary systems very exactly in order to allow the experimentalists at LIGO and the data analysis at LIGO to actually pull the gravitational wave signal out of very noisy data. So tidal interactions have a variety of effects. So the tidal interaction, of course, is just the statement that the gravitational force here and here are different on the neutron star, so as they go around each other, they're each immersed in a tidal field, which causes them to deform. And this deformation can have various effects. The deformation can lead to torques on the neutron stars, which tend to spin them up. And this spin-up continues until they actually co-rotate with the binary's orbit. Now, this is what could happen. This is not what happens for neutron stars. But in principle, torques will spin up components of tidally interacting systems, just like the moon currently always has the same face to Earth. That's because tidal torques spun it up to that point. The motion of the tidal bulge across or around the fluid body, the star, can also dissipate energy. And that dissipation of energy is going to drain energy out of the orbit and stick it into heating up the stars. It also tends to circularize the orbit. So this is another effect of tidal forces. When tidal forces are strong in a system, the system tends to tidally lock its rotation, and it tends to circularize, and it can heat up the components of the system. Okay? Now, this was all studied in neutron stars. The basic linearized effects were studied back in the early 90s, and in fact also transitory resonances with some of the natural modes of neutron stars were studied by Dong Lai in 1994. And the end result is that tides don't do much to neutron star binaries. The reason being that the stars are so compact, they don't really sample much of the tidal field. The tidal bulges are very small. Not much happens. What that means is that these effects of tidal energy loss don't actually have much of an impact on the gravitational wave phase. And in fact, it wasn't until moderately recently that anyone even realized that there was possibly an observable effect of tidal fields on neutron stars. And that's the work of Flanagan and Hinderer and many people who followed them, who realized that the change in the neutron star's gravitational field due to its deformation would actually affect the phase possibly at a level that could be detected. But that's about it. And that effect might be used to measure the equation of state in neutron star binaries. Now, this nice picture that tides aren't really important in neutron stars was threatened this year. When Weinberg, Aras, and Burkhardt in 2013, I think it was in February, mid-February, put out this paper, which claimed a sort of interesting idea. They claimed to have found an effect next to leading order in perturbation theory, which indicated that actually these stars would become unstable to the growth of their own normal modes because they were tidally perturbed. And this growth of the normal modes could actually have a big impact on the binary. So before I talk about what impact they predicted, I'm going to quickly just do a couple slides on the normal modes of stars, which are the sort of math that will go into this. Again, all Newtonian. You start with a static star, and you add some Lagrangian perturbations to that star, and you stick those Lagrangian perturbations into the continuity and fluid equations, and you end up with sort of a simple-looking evolution equation for the displacement field, where you've got two derivatives and some sort of internal operator and equaling some external forces on the star. This is where the tidal forces are going to sit, and this is where the star's own self-gravity and pressure and so forth sits. What you can do then is, for each individual star, you can solve for its normal modes, which are going to oscillate with some characteristic frequencies. And then furthermore, the normal modes themselves satisfy a spatial eigenvalue equation. So we're already sort of looking at a situation sort of familiar from black hole perturbation theory, but other places, where this operator operates on the eigenfunctions and gives you back the frequency. So this is all at linear level. This is what linear theory tells you. Given a stellar model and a lot of work and some computers, because these things have complicated structures, you can solve for these frequencies and these eigenfunctions, which actually tell you how the perturbation is distributed across the star. What you learn from this in general is there are sort of three types of modes on stars. Okay, there's high frequency modes, high frequency with respect to the natural sort of gravitational dynamical time of the star, called the P modes. These are just pressure wave modes. They're mostly radial. They're like sound waves. There's the low frequency G modes. These are gravity modes. These are gravity modes as in ocean wave gravity modes. So they move they're mostly horizontal, and they're low frequency. And then there's a fundamental F mode, which sort of rings at about the gravitational dynamical time of the star. Okay, so keep these three things in mind: high frequency P modes, low frequency G modes. This is characteristic of all stars. So now you want to move on to nonlinear interactions. So in moving to the next order, you're going to decompose the Lagrangian of the star into the linearized normal modes. Okay? And so for that, you've got a kinetic term, which is the sum of the linear modes, and some potential. And this potential itself has the leading order term, which is like the spring constant. But then you start to have mode-mode interactions. So there's a three-mode interaction, which couples three different oscillations together. There's a four-mode and a five-mode and a six-mode interaction here. And then you also have the external effects. So in this case, this term tells you how a displacement samples the external perturbation U. Okay, so the overall picture now is you have a system of coupled forced oscillators, where each of those oscillators in the original picture were the decoupled linearized modes, but in the nonlinear picture now they talk to each other. Okay? So when you're thinking now about how this picture works with tides, what you're interested in is saying the tide is going to be this external perturbation applied to the star, and that external perturbation is going to help those modes talk to each other. Okay? It's going to induce the coupling. Okay, so how does that work? You have an external potential. It's weak, so I put an epsilon parameter in front of it. This is the tidal strength. This leads to a leading order response, which is some sum of the linearized modes. And we're just going to focus throughout this talk on the potential term. Okay, and so what having this leading order response does is, putting it back in this potential term, we have a big matrix, which where every mode is an entry in a big column. This matrix is the coupling matrix of the system of oscillators. Okay, and its eigenvalues then are the perturbed eigenvalues of the system. Okay, so the coupled oscillators now have their new normal modes with their own normal mode frequencies, and they look sort of like this. If you had a P mode in the beginning, it's now got some sort of self-perturbation at order epsilon and then some higher perturbation at epsilon squared. But it also has a coupling term. Part of that coupling term is coming in from the tide. And then the other two parts of this three-mode coupling couple from the tide into another mode, like the G mode. So this G mode now has its own perturbations, plus it's talking to the P mode. All right, with all of that laid out, and I know it's sort of a lot of equations, unfortunately, in this talk compared to the other, but this is a very mathematical result we worked on. We can, now I can talk about the non-resonant instability that Weinberg, Aras, and Burkhardt talked about. So we have these off-diagonal coupling terms. What we can say is the following. This is what they sort of wrote out in their paper, is that that coupling term, this coupling between these three modes, it actually depends on spatial integrals of the linearized eigenmodes. And if those modes happen to be resonant spatially, that integral can turn out to be a large number. Now, you wouldn't normally think this happens, but it turns out it can happen when you have a very high overtone P mode and a very high overtone G mode, and I mean like overtone 100. These are very hard to find, and you cannot sort of numerically evolve a system with enough resolution to find these kinds of modes. It turns out that these modes generally can be found where they have a spatial resonance. Their spatial wave numbers are about equal. And in that case, since these two are the ones that are oscillating quickly, spatially, and the tide is just sort of a zero node perturbation, this integral over the three can be large. And in fact, what they showed was it can be the frequency. Excuse me, I've got a bad cold lately. It can be the frequency ratio of the two modes. Now, remember, before I said that these could be high frequency, these could be low frequency, this frequency ratio can actually be gigantic, 10 to the 6 or more. Okay? And that gigantic frequency ratio can compete with the weakness of the tidal field. And what that means is that off-diagonal term can get quite big. And when you compute the perturbed eigenvalues, so what used to be a G mode, we'll now call omega minus, it receives its own self-correction that I talked about before, and then it receives a correction from the off-diagonal mode. Just like in ordinary quantum mechanics, right? This is going to be the square of the off-diagonal mode and some ratio of the energies. And when you work it out, to your horror, you discover that this really tiny frequency is getting a negative correction, which is like some small number times some huge number squared. Now, if this eigenmode squared goes negative, that means this mode will grow. And what that means physically is that the tidal field is somehow dumping its energy into the production of a pair of modes. One is a P mode and one is a G mode. They're in perfect resonance with each other spatially or near perfect resonance spatially. And that G mode is now unstable to getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Okay?
Once you begin to talk about this scale of the time model, don't you worry about the effects of viscosity? Which, of course,
yeah, so that's an excellent question. In this talk, I'm not going to mention viscosity because we're actually going to show that this doesn't happen. In their paper, they did worry about viscosity. They put in realistic values of viscosity. And all that, of course, does is it provides you with a criterion. This now competes with some viscous damping term, which it turns out it's not hard for this to beat that viscous damping term. So they did worry about that. We don't have to worry about it because it turns out this is just not right.
Something along the lines of what Keith was mentioning.
Yeah.
So higher orders in absolute might, because roughly speaking, that is an indication that your perturbation extension might break down.
Yes.
So it might require
yes. So no, that's exactly right. And in fact, there's a few things going on here. One is the effect they are arguing for. So let me see if it's on the next slide. I've already forgotten about my talk. Yeah, okay. So what does this mean? If one mode is going unstable, of course, linearized perturbation theory is going to break down. So the argument is now the following. We don't know what's going to happen next, but what we do believe is that the G mode is going to grow to a big amplitude during the in spiral of two neutron stars. Okay? And if it grows to a big amplitude, eventually it's going to be dissipated by some nonlinear mechanism, which you don't know.
When
right?
You know that it would grow, is the next order term, which is say absolute to the force times omega p to the force comes with a plus sign.
Right.
That would not be growing.
So what will happen is that that these modes could possibly grow until the higher order terms in it will come in and saturate. And that's what I mean by a nonlinear effect. So you get to the point where you actually have to worry about the full nonlinear field equation, full nonlinear fluid equations, right? And that's the only way to know what really happens. And they admit that. And in their paper, all they do is they provide one mechanism for saturating the G mode, which is sort of a reasonable mechanism. But nevertheless, what they show in their paper is that reasonable mechanism for putting a cap on the G mode as it starts to grow out of control still ends up dumping a lot of energy out of the through the tide into the stars themselves. And what this means is that the in spiral speeds up. And the really terrible thing from LIGO's perspective is that it speeds up right when it's in the right frequency band for LIGO to be most sensitive, which means that the waveform dephases by a radian or more. Okay? Now that may not seem like much because this thing's going to go through thousands of radians, right, in the sweet spot. I don't even remember anymore, but hundreds to thousands of orbits, LIGO will watch these things. And so you might say, oh, well, it's a small effect for it to dephase by half an orbit. But it totally spoils the matched filtering technique and would really lower the signal-to-noise ratio that LIGO uses because they need a really good, down to, you know, tenths of radians or less prediction in order to do a good job here. And this would be completely unpredictable because you don't know what the nonlinear mechanism is, and it sets in based on some sort of detailed initial conditions of the star, you'd just be done. Another interesting thing for observational people is that it would tend to heat up the neutron stars to quite high temperatures. Okay? So this becomes a problem. This is sort of the punchline of their paper, is that we don't know what nonlinear effect saturates this instability, but it's there, and it's going to be a problem for LIGO, maybe. Probably. Okay. So, but if you were paying really close attention to the talk so far, you've already seen their mistake. But don't worry, I'll go back through it. There's two things to keep in mind here that should make you suspicious. First of all, this is not your classic parametric instability. This effect had nothing to do with the fact that the stars were going around each other. It was an effect that came in because the tide set up a different structure for the star, which allowed one of its eigenmodes to go unstable. So in other words, it's a static instability. If I just took a neutron star and magically held it still and immersed it in a tidal field, that star would suddenly become unstable once the tidal field got sort of above a certain strength. Still weak, but above a certain strength. And what that means is it's almost like a buckling instability where you push on two ends of a beam and set it up to be unstable to suddenly developing a bending mode. The neutron star immersed in a weak tidal field is suddenly unstable to essentially convection. Okay? And that should make you a little suspicious. And it made us suspicious. And so we wanted to revisit this problem. And in fact, all the aspects of the problem are captured in a very simple analogy, which will avoid having all these awful indices running around everywhere. So I'm going to talk about this for a couple slides and then introduce how we're going to solve the problem. Ah, I'm running out of time. All right. So start with a 2D harmonic oscillator, where one of the directions the spring is very stiff and one of the directions the spring is very loose. So the two frequencies have this big ratio between them. Okay? And this is the couple, this is the mass matrix, okay? Just diagonal. Now imagine a small perturbation. And actually, imagine we know that the truth about this perturbation is that we just rotate this matrix by a small angle. If you expand in powers of the theta of the angle, you end up with this kind of situation. Here's your off-diagonal term. You have a small number here and a big number here. Small number here and a big number here. Some cubic terms you don't care about. And you compute. You go ahead and you compute the shift in the frequencies. But we know it's just a rotation. So nothing could have really happened to the size of the eigenvalues. But in fact, what you find is that you find that the smaller eigenvalue gets shifted by a huge number competing with the small angle, just like in the other case. And the answer is that you shouldn't have neglected the order theta squared terms here because these are going to come in squared. And you have to worry about those order theta squared terms. And if you actually take them into account correctly, you see that the mode doesn't actually change its eigenfrequency. But if you didn't take them into account, it looks like the modes went from being rotated actually to being a saddle point. And this is what we think was going on in the Weinberg et al. Results. And the answer is that actually you needed even higher order perturbation theory. You needed to go to four-mode couplings. Because these are going to come in on the diagonals with epsilon squareds. So this is a term which is a spatial integral and a ton of derivatives, really awful, many, many pages to write it out, which couples a mode to itself twice and then to the tide twice. So it's a tide-tide mode. You don't know if that's going to fix the problem. You just know you had to include it to work at that order in the perturbation series. So you got to check. You actually have to compute this to see if it helps. But you know you have to. But what we suspect from the analogy is that the real perturbation is actually just a rotation in eigenspace, which is being confused by the huge difference in frequencies. Okay? And so the way we do this, the way we solve this problem, is we figure out a way to undo that rotation with a coordinate transformation, And we do this through a coordinate transformation and a matching. And this is sort of the crazy, hard, weird part of the calculation, because ultimately we wanted to compute this guy. And I'm going to have to speed through it a little bit because I'm running out of time. But I'll try to give you a flavor of what you do. Okay, so we began with a static neutron star model with a static tidal potential. We're going to use ideal fluid, so no viscosity, but again, that only helps us in trying to disprove the instability. We use the Cowling approximation, which means that you fix the star's internal gravity even though the star deforms. This is a commonly used approximation. It's not very good for the tidal F mode itself, but it is pretty good for these higher order P and G modes because they oscillate rapidly. They sort of sample an averaged out gravitational potential, which hasn't really changed due to their own displacements. And then we do a Newtonian analysis. And so we start with the original potential of the star, and we add the tide. So here's how we go. Start with this star, add the tide. That induces a tidal displacement, chi, to a deformed star. So this is our deformed star. Now we consider a coordinate transform. Okay, this is just a pure coordinate transformation, which we will use an infinitesimal generator of that rotation to sort of characterize that transformation. Since this is small, this will also be small. And what do we do with this? Well, what we actually do, and it's kind of weird, we take the elongated star and we map it back onto a spherical state. It's not the same place you started at. We demand that this coordinate transformation be volume preserving, which between these two demands, that the star becomes spherical and that this be volume preserving, this actually is uniquely identified. We can solve for it rather easily. This final star is actually a little bit different than what you started with. And what you find magically is this final star is as if you'd taken the original star and applied a displacement field which was purely radial. And that purely radial displacement is generated by an external radial potential. Okay? And what does this gain us? Well, this radial star is actually simpler, but the most amazing thing is that you actually erase the leading order of the perturbation. So this field was epsilon to get to here, but if I take this through the coordinate transformation and tide combo, it's only perturbed to epsilon squared. And now if we consider further perturbations, like the P and G modes, off of these stars, well, in this regular coordinate system, we call them eta. Here they're transformed, of course, by the Jacobian. But these two stars are the same as each other. They're just in different coordinate systems. But what's amazing is that if you do the expansion in epsilon, you're already starting at epsilon squared here, whereas you started at epsilon here. And by matching the potentials of these two stars, we're going to get somewhere. So really quickly, the generator we have to take to second order. You're going to have the perturbations on the second star be the Jacobian transform perturbations on the first star. Everything gets projected onto the linear basis, including the Jacobian here and the way the perturbations transform here. So you're picking up all of those complications that it looks like we got rid of. We actually pick up again because we have some transformations here. So nothing's been lost. It's just been moved into a different form. And we can explicitly compute these Jacobians in principle because we knew what the coordinate transform field was. We can solve for it. And what you do is you match. You match the star with tide plus further perturbations to the other star with radial displacement plus transformed perturbations. These are two scalars. You can actually match them. And we do match them, and we match them order by order. The great thing is that the right-hand side, this is the spherical star, it, since it's already at epsilon squared, it only has a tide plus mode plus mode. It only has three-mode coupling at epsilon squared order. While the left-hand side had both the three-mode coupling and the four-mode coupling we're interested in. By carrying out the matching in epsilon, you can take three-mode couplings on the original star and express them entirely in terms of the Jacobian transformation. That's maybe not so special, but the really great thing is that you can express the four-mode coupling of the original star in terms of combinations of the Jacobian that you can, again, calculate fairly easily, plus a lingering three-mode coupling term, which you have to compute explicitly. And then the really amazing thing is that when you actually plug this back into the perturbation of the eigenvalues, the three-mode squared term and the four-mode term cancel almost exactly. Okay? What you end up is something that looks like this. You've got the G-mode plus its own self-interaction, which is small and was never a problem, plus This is essentially the three-mode coupling when it gets big. So this is like omega p over omega g squared. But all that's left at the end is the same term with a suppression factor. So this whole thing is order unity. So this whole thing is just epsilon squared. And so there is no big term at all. There's no big term at all. We were just confused because we were using a terrible basis from the start. Because of this big frequency difference and this perturbation, we were mixing the G modes with the P modes in an unnatural way. And by finding a better basis in some sense, we've solved the problem. Now that's great. We did it all for static stars. Now you want to worry about the real problem. So you can throw in some rotation. It makes the analysis a little bit more complicated, but it's important for the realistic case of a binary neutron star. All you need to do is take the same eigenvalue matrix you had before, add a time-dependent rotation, which introduces some centrifugal terms. That perfect cancellation we had before is spoiled by these centrifugal terms just a little bit. And now what you're worried about is the frequency. Oh, this should have been an omega. I'm sorry. Okay. This should be, no, this is right, mg. Okay. So what you're worried about now is this combined quantity, which is essentially the in the frame of the rotating star, what is the mode frequency? You want to know if this gets negative. So we'll call that omega. This is what we're worried about getting negative. It happens to be equal to the omega minus we calculated in here, which is just not a big deal. But then we do have a different competition of scales. We have the smallness of the tidal field times the rotational velocity of the binary. So it turns out that this non-resonant coupling actually is responsible for bringing this term in. This wouldn't be here otherwise. And in this case, you might worry that, well, as the tidal field gets stronger and the binary speeding up, maybe this instability really will kick in. Okay? It turns out you can do the analysis by order of magnitude and see that in the case of the neutron star binary, because you need this thing to get actually below zero, this term will not beat out this term until sort of late in the n-spiral. And by the time this term starts to beat out this term for realistic g-mode frequencies, you only get about an e-folding of growth before the neutron stars merge, which means from zero to just a little bit more than zero. Not a big deal. Won't have any impact. But for less compact stars, which feel this tidal force more strongly and spend a lot longer time during n-spiral, like white dwarf binaries, this weird G-mode centrifugal instability might actually cause some serious tidal heating or maybe other effects. This is also true perhaps for binary stars or exoplanets that are close to their host stars and strongly tidally interacting. So that's the subject of future work. We might investigate this actual weak centrifugal instability in less compact binaries, or perhaps to solve problems related to tidal dissipation in stellar and planetary binaries. And I threw this in here, but it's hard for me to find other applications. But this matching technique we used in the first place to compute the very challenging four-mode coupling, totally in terms of some coordinate transformations and the three-mode terms, might find application in other fields if you think really hard. So that's the end of my talk. I'm sorry for going over a little bit, but I started late. So I'll take any questions.
The last one, have you thought of perhaps intermediate mass black holes that seem to exist going white dwarfs? Or so there you would increase the tidal field and then play a Bolzer pin. In fact, that there are ideas out there, people are toying around with that you couldn't, maybe brought it here, that maybe you could now use supernovas this way and then
right. Lack
of them might give you an independent way of testing whether there are intermediate mass black holes or not.
So, I mean, the short answer is no. We put out this work just a few months ago, and we have done no follow-up yet. We've all split now. We're each in a different institution, which will make further collaboration a little bit challenging. But yeah, we definitely want to explore the centrifugal instability in particular in other fields, in other places. It's actually a big open question right now how exoplanets, like hot Jupiters close to their stars, they have orbital properties which are very confusing given the amount of tidal dissipation we actually expect. And so there's a theoretical need, based on observations, to figure out better mechanisms for tidal dissipation in those systems. So I hadn't heard about intermediate black holes with white dwarfs, but that's certainly another, any area where there's, the tidal effects may be important could possibly benefit from this. You really, to do this for real though, you really then actually have to compute the structure of the star, figure out what this omega minus is. It's much more of a chore than what we did, which was at a formal level, show a almost exact cancellation of these large terms. But yeah, it's subject to future work. So that almost comes back to here. Exact, this is the three-mode squared term, most of it. This is what gets big. If it were truly exact, this would be gone entirely, but what it really does is it cancels all but a piece which has the suppressing factor in front of it. So this suppressing factor cancels the large factor hiding inside this guy when you actually compute him. And that's what I mean by almost exact. This isn't zero, but it is something of order unity, which then gets suppressed by the smallness of the tidal field. So it's not a problem. The problem before was...
It's positive, by the way.
That's a good point. I'll have to think about that. I think I got the sign right. So yeah, it is positive. I think it's positive. Yeah, it is positive. It is positive. So yeah, anyway, it's not going to be a negative thing.
So if I interpret this result as if it were the correct result version of the previous one, where you went to sufficiently high order to actually include all, can I go back and I just take your result and drop a few terms and see? So the fact, I was expecting to see some negative number in there that was completely compensated by some other term, but now it's gone. So I don't see how I would get the previous result by taking...
No. You get the previous result just like in the analogy. So in the silly analogy, this is the negative number, and this is the positive number. And if you drop this positive number entirely, there's their result. They didn't have this piece. So the correct thing would not be to say that we resummed. The correct thing would be to say they ignored this term. I think they talk about it a little bit. They don't talk about it in a context which implies that they saw that this term was actually at the same order in epsilon as this term. So I think they just made a small oversight, which turned out to be very important. But this term should have been there from the beginning. The more charitable interpretation of their work might be to say that they did think about this term, but they decided that the four-mode coupling just had to be small, because they do have some arguments in their paper why the next order, which is the four-mode couplings, can't be important. Yeah. But it's just that you needed to be consistent in the first place. That was the problem.
To talk to those people. Ooh. So did they agree with it? It was very reasonable.
Everyone asked this, and I guess this is the question you should be prepared for whenever you write a rebuttal paper. We have been in contact with Nevin. He's not, you know, been mean. He's, you know, we're having a conversation about it. Basically, I think their work was done from the perspective of the equations of motion, from which this cancellation is very not obvious. If you work at it from the level of the mass matrices, these guys, it's much more obvious. So we're trying to, I think, convince him right now that some extra more complicated things. One thing that you might worry about, actually, is that this is not just one P mode and one G mode. We did all these 2x2 matrices in our paper to not be confusing. But in fact, this is an N by N matrix, even at the 2-mode coupling level. And you can have 100 P modes coupling to one G mode, and you've got to cancel each and every one of those. And while the results in our paper demonstrate how that works explicitly, I think we're having a little bit of trouble just convincing him that that happens. But I think we're going to converge to an agreement soon. Yeah.
I think it's important because there might be some. I think it's a great resolution. It looks like great.
Yeah, I mean, there are some loopholes. So yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I think Nevin is worried about some possible loopholes. And I think that's fair. And I think, I mean, this picture to me is beautiful, but it's extremely confusing. And it's not obvious that this will work. But it really does if you follow through the math. And I think the analogy to the rotated oscillator gives you the physical understanding. But you do need to try to poke holes in it. And so I really do hope that eventually we can convince people other than ourselves that this is the right resolution to the issue. These many mode things, these higher order perturbations, they're just crazy like this, right? Because if you start worrying about which of the countable infinite modes is having trouble and instabilities with some other member of that set, it's really hard to plug all the holes that people can imagine. Yeah, but if you're interested, read the, you can read our paper. I think we tried to explain this carefully.
Okay, let's thank Harry again.
Thank you.